to the long-awaited return of ATT Confidential. I'm Braden.
I'm Dan.
And I am revved up like a nuke.
Yep, gruesome, twosome, back, full effect.
Yeah. Those other guys were trying to hold us down.
Right, for so long.
They had us down for a while, but now we're back. The Demon Core is what we're talking about today. if anyone who listens to ATD Confidential, you know Dan and I love conspiracies, but we also love military shenanigans.
Weird science.
And weird science, 100%. And this fits into those. It just fits in. The Demon Core is basically a story about people having no fucking idea what they're doing.
No, I would say it's even better than that. It's like they knew exactly what they were messing with, and they had the gall and the hubris to think that they could fuck with it.
Yeah, like the OSH committees or whatever back then, the Occupational Health and Safety Committees, were not very good. 100%.
Yeah. I don't even know. I'm not even 100% sure they existed.
Because there was like no, like, yeah, just, I'm sure they had safety protocols, but like many things, like this was, you know, cowboy time, nuclear cowboys. I think he had said that.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with the Demon Core, which admittedly I had never heard of until Braden brought it up, the Demon Core was actually part of the third atomic bomb. Well, technically fourth. The third atomic bomb after the two were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the core of the third bomb was another one that had been produced, and they were going to drop in a third bombing run on Japan. Fortunately for them, they surrendered. So the core never made it to where it was supposed to go.
So this core is a 6 kilogram subcritical mass of plutonium, 89 millimeters in diameter.
Right. So it's a little bit larger, if you think of it, like in your head, it's a little bit larger than a baseball.
Yeah. But so much more worse.
So much worse. Yeah. It began as, you know, they had plutonium rods or uranium rods, which is a relatively stable isotope. And what they did is they took the rods and they put them in a nuclear reactor, and they just soaked them in neutrons, because that's how you get, that's how you build a nuclear core for a bomb. At least you excite the uranium up a couple atomic levels and get it ready for, it's basically ready to explode at any given moment. So, but in order to put it inside a bomb, you have to work it into a suitable shape. So you can't just have like a giant rock of, you know, a bunch of edges and corners and stuff. So they had to form it into a tiny little ball. And so they worked it together with gallium, which they found to be the ideal kind of metal to be able to put it together and form it into what they needed it to be. So they put it together and they took, they made two hemispheres and they put them together. And it's like, it's fucking crazy. They're just like, yeah, this is good. This is awesome. Like, I'm sure that it was amazing at the time. I can't imagine the excitement that you would be feeling.
Oh, and not to mention that, like, this is being made because you're like, this is for a bomb. Like, this has a purpose. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, hey, scrap the plans on the third bomb. The first two, you know, worked spectacularly. It was horrifying. The whole country surrendered instantly. We don't need the third one. They're like, well, what do we do with this core? What do we do with this little ball? And they're like, I don't know. Should we start testing? Let's name it. And let's start running tests, doing tests on it.
Yeah, so they weren't exactly 100% sure what to do with it. I mean, it wasn't going to become a bomb. And they had first thought that they were going to use it in another another nuclear test, which was called Operation Crossroads. And Operation Crossroads actually became the testing of two different types of atomic bombs. You had one implosion type called Able, and you had another one called Baker. One was detonated atmospherically, like the first two atomic bombs were. So basically up, you know, relatively high altitude. You detonate the bomb in the air, you know, and the shockwave and the heat just slams into the ground. That's that one. But they hadn't actually really tested one below water because they wanted to know, you know, if possibly you had to use it in a naval engagement, what kind of effects would it have on, you know, destroyers, aircraft carriers, things like that. So the Baker was actually the implosion type detonated underwater. And you can pull up videos of that one. That's a really famous one you see, that, you know, you just see the huge, like, coming up from out of the water. Like, you think it's Godzilla, but it's not. And those were those Operation Crossroads was the first public testing of nuclear bombs, because before you dropped the first two, you had Trinity, which was the only test they did. That was the only test run they did before they actually dropped the bombs. So they'd really only seen it in action one time before they dropped the first two. And yeah, these are the next ones after that. And they invited people to come watch it because, you know, it's like, hey, we got these weapons of complete mass destruction. Why don't you come and check them out?
Come watch. We don't know what they'll do, but come watch us blow them up.
So, yeah.
So they have the core and they're starting to do tests. Now the issue with the core is because it was made for a bomb, it's designed to be at, I don't know if I'm saying this right. I'm not a physicist, especially a nuclear one. Surprise, surprise.
Wait, what?
Minus 5 cents. So basically there is like not a lot of margin of error, and any kind of reactivity will cause this core to become super critical, and then prompt critical and a brief state of rapid energy increase. So basically like a sliver of safety area to work with. And then if you fuck up at all, you die.
Right. Now, they're not talking about like super critical. They're not talking about an explosion. So it's not like it's going to be a nuclear explosion, but it would end up releasing, because you would excite it to the next, you know, atomic level. You would basically just release the energy from that increase, would release like a huge wave of radiation, just pure radiation.
Yeah. Hence the name that this thing got, Demon Core, because we're going to talk about two infamous incidents of some wild testing going on back in the 40s. And yeah, so the first incident we had, and first off, this is the first incident had a physicist named Harry Dagalian Jr. And then you had a special engineer guard, Private Robert J. Hammerly. So they're the only two people working in the lab. And the first thing I thought when I first learned about this case is Harry Dagalian, who's the physicist, who's like in charge of working on it, at the time of the incident was 24 years old. Now, I'm just saying, as someone who's 30, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence that someone 24 years old was working on this fucking demon core. To me, it seems a little too young, Dan. What do you think?
I mean, at this point, Harry had actually participated in the Manhattan Project, I believe. He had been part of the development of the first nuclear bomb. And, you know, yeah, 24, you're probably not making the best decisions, you know, because you're young. You think you're pretty much invulnerable. And stack on top of that, the hubris of being one of the people to invent the A-bomb, and you've been working with these materials of, you know, familiarity with these materials gives you that kind of feeling of control, that the idea that it's like, I can do whatever I want, I know what I'm doing, you know, put that on your youthful feeling of immortality, and it's probably pretty much a recipe for disaster.
So the first experiment, what they wanted to do is they were setting up like external reflectors, and they wanted to reflect outbound neutrons back into the core. And this experiment was to prove that this the core was indeed close to the critical point by arranging reflectors to see how much neutron reflection was required to approach super criticality. So basically around this demon core, they have all these little reflectors stacked and they're going to measure the neutrons.
Yeah. And they were familiar with this. They had done these kinds of experiments before when Harry had, you know, this was days, literally days after, they had canceled the bombing run in Japan. Japan had surrendered. So I don't know if Harry Daglin might have been a little bit, you know, liquored up after the celebration. Because, I mean, just days after Japan had surrendered, World War II is over. I mean, you would be understandably excited. But, you know, he might have just gone in there just to mess with it because it's like, well, I don't know what we're going to do with it. They had become so familiar with this core that they had actually like named it. It was almost like a mascot to their department, their research department. So it was like, they named it Rufus. Mm-hmm. and they had actually jokingly or kind of knowingly, they called it kind of experiments where they would set up these types of reflectors to kind of, you know, excite the core and reach towards the point that you would think it would go super critical. They called it tickling the dragon's tail.
Hilarious, because even calling it that, obviously they had some foresight of like, yeah, we are gonna die.
Yeah, if you call it tickling the dragon's tail, like, what do you think is going to happen? And, you know, you go in there and you're just, you know, I assume it's just that idea, you know, it's hubris. The guy's like, I know what I'm doing. I'm perfectly, you know, you have that one. I think just about everybody knows that kind of person, has interacted with that person, whether it's on a job site or something where they feel like they know everything. They know exactly what's going to happen. You know, I know how far I can push this. You know, nothing's going to happen. You know, I know when to let off. I know when to whatever. Nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. So Harry was like with this, he was working alone in the lab, and he had a security guard, Private Robert Hammerly, was seated at a desk 10 to 12 feet away. Basically, this core is stacked within a stack of these neutron reflective tungsten carbide bricks. So he's stacking these bricks around. He's, again, manually with his hands stacking these bricks around the core. And each brick, he moved the assembly closer to criticality. Now, while attempting to stack another brick around the assembly, and I can only assume because of what happened, he was trying to stack a brick on top of the brick walls he's built around the sides to have a brick on top. And he drops the brick onto the core, instantly causing the core to go into super criticality. A self-sustaining chain reaction. It's bad. Quickly though, within seconds, he quickly grabs a brick, takes it off the assembly. I'm sure him and, because it's not like it makes a noise or anything.
Right. At most, you'd probably see when it does that, it ionizes the air around it and you get like this blue glow. You can look up videos of it. They have at least one. There's like a nuclear. There's a video of a nuclear reactor on YouTube. Just pull it up, like air ionization, and it'll show you what happens. Like when you excite a nuclear core into like supercriticality to like produce energy, it just, you know.
Yeah. So he immediately removes it. I'm sure him and Private Robert exchange a quick one of those oh fuck glances. Oh no. And like the thing is, you wouldn't know right away. So I'm sure they thought, oh, it's all good, right? especially Private Hemmerly, who's just sitting at a desk. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just there as a guard. Well, this basically is the end of Harry Dagland. He receives a fatal dose of radiation. Now, he doesn't die instantly. He dies 25 days later from the acute radiation syndrome. He got 200 rads.
Let me tell you, brothers, about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges. From sleepless nights to stress-filled days, Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends, brother. And they've got gummies for literally everything. Immunosupport, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, sexual arousal. No pesticides, brother. No BS. And they ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ALIEN. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember, brothers and sisters, use that promo code ALIEN at checkout and save 20% on your first order.
And 110 rads of gamma. So basically, he was close to becoming the Hulk.
Almost. Not quite.
Almost.
Though.
You know, they said his he basically burnt through his hand where he had grabbed the brick from the radiation. And they said that, like, basically burned all his internal organs.
Right. He had been cooked from the inside out.
Yeah.
Or like, pretty much like cooked all the way through, I think. Yeah, would kind of be the
yeah, instantly. And it just took a while for it to get to the outside.
Yeah. And it's funny, like, I think you have to picture in your head, like, I think some people might have the picture in the head of, like, you know, guys in white lab coats, you know, the glasses, and this nice, you know, beakers, burners, this nice organized lab that you'd be thinking about, stainless steel and all this. It wasn't that. It was like, it's just like a regular room, you know, with maybe like a classroom. Yeah. Some desks and stuff. And there wasn't like stainless steel equipment. The guy wasn't using, you know, any type of manipulating tools. There's not like anything like that. The guy was just literally just taking these big metal bricks and just like stacking them. Like you go into a kindergarten room and you see some kid stacking blocks on the ground. Like that's what he was doing, except around a, like a 5 cent supercritical nuclear core.
So obviously, tragically, Harry Dagland Jr. dies. Private Robert J. Hemmerly received, he was 10 to 12 feet away, and he didn't get dosed, but he did get leukemia at the age of 62 that they attribute to the radiation exposure from that day. But he, you know, he lived another 33 years, but I mean, that would have been, cause I couldn't imagine if you're sitting there and you're like, all right, hey, you got to sit in this room where the guys are going to play with the bomb, like that just won us the war. And you're like, am I okay? Am I going to be safe in there? And they're like, yeah, 100%. You're safe. Just sit at the desk, man. It's just scientists that are just going to do stuff. And you're sitting there and you see them, this guy stacking bricks. You're probably just chilling. Bored,
I mean,
as hell.
He probably knew. I mean, they probably knew them by face. They're just like, hey, Harry, oh, yeah. You know, hey, what's up?
Hey,
you
hey,
know?
What's going on? And he's like, I'm just going to do some tests today. And then the air around him turns blue. He'd be like, what? Holy shit.
Fuck.
What's going on? Everything all good, Harry? He's like,
he's like shaking his hand because they said that he felt a tingling like instantly like after he removed the thing. Like he felt a tingling in his hand. The guy, I mean, he knew they had, yeah. He had to know that like shit was fucked.
The writing was on the wall for him. He's yeah. Done. So obviously, I mean, after a disastrous and okay. You know what? Here's the thing. We don't give Harry a lot of credit because, you know, he still grabbed that brick. And he stopped what could have been a way worse event if they would have run out of the room or something, right? So good on him for fixing his mistake. But obviously after this, like knowing these human errors, they obviously made you know, things way safer. And they stopped doing these wild tests. Right, Dan?
No. Back then, it was kind of like they took a couple more. I think they took a couple more precautions when they after this tragic event happened. You know, the brutally cutting short of what could have been. You know, the guy was a genius. Obviously, he's 24 years old. He's working on the Manhattan Project, and then you know, months later, dead. But you know, I think the mainly the precautions they took after this event was they put in a couple more. They put in a couple more monitoring devices was really their big thing. And I think they wanted to have more people watching it. But again, these are scientists, like these are scientists in the 1950s. And it's like, when I picture scientists in the 1950s, it's like, you know, if you think of, Jonas Venture, like that's, yeah. Like, that's who
yeah,
I think
100%.
Of. It's like, he screwed up, but that's no reason to think that we will, like, you know, so they're just like, okay, it's like, that won't happen again. Everybody learned their lesson. Good. It's like, don't be a Harry.
So in May 21st, 1946, this is where the story gets a little bit of a Canadian connection here. Louis Slotin from good old Winnipeg, Manitoba. He's working on the lab. Now he's a physicist, 35 years old. And they have, you know, it still looks like they're in some weird middle school kitchen, that they're doing these experiments in, but they have made some measures when they're doing these tests. They fashion these, two half spears of beryllium that act as a neutron reflector. And basically, the core sits in one, and then they have another beryllium sphere with a hole on top that can be lowered down, over top. But the thing is you do not want these two beryllium spheres to touch. If they touch and seal around, it will instantly cause the demon core to go into super criticality and kill everyone. So they've also made these special shims, and these shims basically lay down to ensure that the spheres can never touch. You lay these shims down before you lower it. And again, do they have a machine doing this? Do they touch it? Fuck no. They have someone manually do it. Why it's important to have the shims, so then you can lay the shims down, you get the sphere, and you lower the sphere very carefully onto the shims. Nothing ever touches, and everything's safe and sound. Cue Canada.
So, Lewis decides that, well, you know what? These shims are either getting in the way or they're not, and things aren't going as fast as I want them to. So he comes up with
the shims.
He says, fuck these shims. And he thinks that the best way to go ahead and do this, or either the quicker way, is to instead remove the shims and manually manipulate the half spheres using the, I'm sure precisely calibrated science grade flathead screwdriver.
So this fucking crazy motherfucker would put his thumb in the top hole of the beryllium sphere, wrap his hand around so his fingers were wrapped, so his fingers were acting as the shim on one side, and on the other side he would balance it on a flathead screwdriver and lower it down onto the core. Like, I'm speechless. When I first heard this, I was like, he what? How did not, there was other scientists in the room. Like, how did not anyone go like, hey, when is this? 1946? When did the first guy get melted? He's like,
months before August, August of the year before.
Not even a year ago. The guy who helped invent these basically got melted. Because these things touch.
Well done from the inside out.
And he's like, well, that's what the screwdriver's for, to ensure that doesn't happen.
And they're all just kind of looking at him, like shaking his head, like, what? And they're like, oh no, he's from Canada.
Yeah. I wonder if he was French a little bit. He Is he French Canadian? No, no. Because I just remember he'd be like, "You stupid American." But no, so, as you can imagine, so May 21st, 1946. He was leaving Los Alamos. Slotin was leaving. I guess he was sick of working with the Dima Corps, and he was basically teaching his technique to a new physicist that was coming on called Alvin Graves. And this would be the final,
he was basically training his replacement.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, we have these shims, but listen, fuck the shims. I like to ride the lightning here and use this. So he's showing them. In the middle of fucking showing this guy his back ass, like, not safely at all. He's just like, yeah, this is what I do.
And working in an engineering plant, now that I'm thinking about it, about this, is like, oh my God, this hasn't changed. I'm sure a lot of people can say the same thing, where you have somebody training you doing something, either on a piece of equipment or, you know, procedure to do something. And they're like, okay, we have this like 60 page operating manual about how to do this and how to safely do this. You see this thing? Fuck this thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Flathead screwdriver goes in here. Finger goes in here.
Don't let him. The game is don't let him touch.
So they're all sitting in there. And so I think one of the changes that they had made was that when people were messing with the Demon Corps, they were supposed to have more than one scientist in the room from then on, you know, which I don't exactly know how that would help, because it's just, I feel like, you know, you're supposed, I guess they assumed that another person in there would be like, hey, don't do that. Or, you know what? They probably more thought that, hey, instead of, you know, if you drop that tungsten brick, somebody will be there to catch it. You know, I'm not 100% sure on the thought process. I like thought another scientist there would help.
And we say cowboy because Louis Slotin was basically had done this test on dozens of occasions, and he was usually wearing his trademark, and they say trademark, that's not my word, that's their word for him, his trademark blue jeans and cowboy boots. And he would do these tests in a room full of observers. And one time Enrico Fermi told Slotin and the others that they would be dead within a year if they continued performing the tests like this.
So, you know, Lewis is sitting in there. He's screwing it with it. Screwdriver. Haha. And so, of course, human error. I mean, what do you think's going to happen? Pink. Right.
Yeah. Screwdriver slips.
The other scientist in the room, Raymer Schraber, hears this sound, the pink, hears the dome, punk, you know, and he turns around. Also feeling heat, he said he felt like heat on his back, and he turned around and saw the blue flash, which they had learned to attribute to a nuclear core going supercritical, and just blue flash went through it, all through the room. And you could probably see it from the windows. You could see it from the windows too. So if you're picturing it in your head, it's one of those things in the movies where you see like a giant flash of light just like shoot out the windows. Just like shunk.
Oh, 100%.
And they said it couldn't have lasted. That flash of light is super quick. So it's not like a few tenths of a second at most. And they said Slotin, to his credit, acted pretty quickly, flipping the tamper piece off. So, you know, getting it off there pretty quick. There were seven other people in the room, including a photographer and the security guard, you know, Schraber, Slotin, and the dude he was training up. And they were all exposed to the gigantic burst of radiation that was unleashed.
Well, and that Louis Slotin, you got to remember, because the top had a hole and he had his thumb in the hole, and he was leaning over top of it, he got blasted with a direct shot of radiation. He basically, because of the where he was standing and stuff, he shielded most of the others from getting too much. He himself got 1,000 rads, which is, let's see, Harry Daglian got 200 and died 25 days later. Louis Slotin got 1,000. He was, I don't know if this is a technical term, but quispy.
And we all know it takes 1,001 rads to become the Hulk. So
yeah, not enough. Another near Hulk dosage. Basically, Louis Slotin was cooked alive. They said he had 3-dimensional burns on every single one of his organs, like third degree. Like, he was toast. He died 9 days later from acute radiation syndrome.
Yeah, and just so you know, internal organs not supposed to get sunburned. That's what your skin is for.
That's what three-dimensional. Yeah, that's what they call it. Third dimension, like 3D. Sunburn on all your organs.
Yeah. And so that 1,001 rads put him down pretty quick. 9 days after he let that screwdriver slip, he was gone. And it was remarked later, according to Schreiber, that after he had dropped the screwdriver and the whole thing had happened, Slotin had just like stood there resigned. Like, it was just like, well, that does it. That was it. That's all he said. Cause he knew, Slotin was friends, with Daglian. Like, he had been there when Daglian had died, like in his bed, from that thing. They actually ended up dying in the same room.
Yeah. See, it's crazy to me that like he would have firsthand knowledge of the first incident and then be just so nonchalant.
I mean, I can't possibly imagine what that feeling is like. People might know people who have had terminal cancer, stage 4 cancer diagnosis or something like that, where it's like, I'm sorry, like you're going to die, but that's somebody telling you, kind of secondhand that you're going to die. An expert nonetheless, but somebody telling you you're going to die. But you know, there's always like these weird, you get that kind of idea in your head where it's like, chances are, that might go into remission. Something might happen, new treatment, whatever. But to be the expert, to actually have seen this happen months before, and 100% is like, I'm a dead man. It's something completely different. And I don't know how he didn't go insane after that.
I don't think he probably had much time to go insane, since he started melting, I imagine, right after.
Yeah, like multiple organ failure super quick. And it is just, downhill in 9 days. Like, that's something.
Yeah, terrifying.
So after that, they really stopped calling it like, they stopped calling it the friendly name Rufus. And it was after that event that they actually called it the Demon Corps. And eventually, they stopped messing with it, because after this, like, they actually, safety protocols were heavy safety protocols were instituted. And they decided that nobody's going to screw with this stuff unless you're using machines. Because I think, at that point, I think robotics had kind of come away, or hydraulic machining had come through to a point where it's like you could use mechanical hands. If you look up, there's actually a lot of cool videos of people using like manipulators at the time, which they had built to do these kinds of operations. So they're like, yeah, we're done with the shit. We are 100% using robot hands. Nobody's going near these things.
Yeah. We're done. Any personnel, when these experiments are being performed, have to be 1/4 mile away. Right. Like, it's crazy. Cause I'm like, they already knew all this information. They didn't implement it. And like all these people, I mean, most of the people lived, they lived somewhat longer lives. I mean, everyone died from, basically diseases they associate with the dosage of radiation they received. The longest living live 52 years after the incident, or 55 years after the incident. But they don't know what he died from because he refused to take part in the study. Most of them died from cancers and stuff like that.
Yeah. They had a perfect understanding of what this thing was, and it, whether that gave them the confidence that they displayed, the brazenness to like fuck with this kind of thing, where it's like, I know exactly where it's, I know exactly when it's going to become a danger to my health, and I'm going to mess with it and do whatever I want with it. It's perfectly fine. It does remind me of, it reminds me of animal trainers. You get some of those animal trainers, like, I know my animal, but it's still a wild animal.
You have no idea what it's going to do.
You have no idea what's going on inside its head. And it's still nature. It's gonna turn around and bite you the second you turn your back, and you let your guard slip, and you do something like stick a flathead screwdriver at it, poke it with a flathead screwdriver.
Good thing this ushered in an age, though, of just bizarre atomic culture of like, we knew what this stuff did, but like we said at the beginning, they would have watching parties for these explosions.
Yeah. People would gather, and when they did the explosions, they continued doing testing at the Nevada test site, like 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas. And you could literally go to Fremont Street, where Fremont Street is now, and they would have nuclear atomic bomb watching parties. Like, people would go there and hang out in their cars, park their cars, and watch them detonate atmospheric atomic bombs. It was like the cool thing to do. I mean, also given back then, Las Vegas wasn't like the casino, oasis it is today, but I mean, it'd be the only thing to do out there. But
now, like, is that even a safe distance away from nuclear bombs?
I don't think they had any idea. Like, I think that, I'm not sure off the top of my head what the average fallout is from those types of bombs, those ones, but I know they judged it to mostly be safe. there's a whole thing between, like, because nuclear fallout, the particles, whether it's dirt, dust, whatever, that becomes irradiated in a nuclear explosion, that you don't know where it's going to cause. I mean, wind direction, humidity, all that kind of stuff affects that kind of things. But would you want to be anywhere near a nuclear explosion? Probably not. Like, it just wouldn't be.
Or let alone watch it. Be close enough to watch it.
Yeah.
No. This did usher in a really weird time in the US of like atomic culture. Like, even, you had in the 50s and 60s, atomic gardens, right? Where people would blast. It sounds crazy. It sounds crazy and sounds made up, but you would blast your gardens with radiations and try to mutate plants. And this is actually still done. And it still accounts for grapefruit? Like, a whole bunch of like what we eat now is attributed to atomic gardening.
Right. Back then, atomic power was seen as not only it was like a gateway into the future. That was, it has become the most powerful weapon, but also it was seen as the kind of like the advancement of humankind. And we had harnessed the power of the atom, and the possibilities were endless. And you could use it for all kinds of weird stuff, which is, displayed by the tons and tons of atomic culture that was developed around these things. Around the 1950s, 1960s, you had people, everything from like ice cream to tire, to like road tires. Atomic, whatever. You want to put that on everything.
These are atomic tires.
Right. And that would just make it, because it was cool. It was a sign of hope at that time. But it was also you know, if you fully understood it, it was also terrifying to have this kind of hanging over your head, especially, you know, at the time before the Soviets had actually acquired nuclear bomb technology. It was probably a thing like, you know, it's definitely an American thing or North American thing where it was like, yeah, this is cool. We can use atomic energy to do anything. And that was also kind of part of the United States is a little bit of propaganda where they're putting out like nuclear, they're portraying nuclear power as this new thing that we can use to make superheroes, to, you know, power cities, things like that. Even though none of that ever really came to fruition. Right. I think most of the scientists knew that's like, you're not going to make super, what if you get bombarded by radiation, a person, like we just saw what happened.
Yeah. They're like, the Hulk is ludicrous.
And it's just, but it also is fascinating about how it just took hold and how it influenced the development of kind of pop culture and North American culture for, you know, 20 years or 20, 30 years. And it's still, even now, there's parts of it. I mean, you got Fallout, which kind of plays on that culture. Everything's atomic. Everything's powered by nuclear fission, fusion, whatever. Yeah. You know, still today we call the bathing suits the bikini, which is named after Bikini Atoll, where, you know, we did nuclear tests.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And even, you know, even still today, our favorite monster, Godzilla, is still around, and he's still either, you can call it a, you know, whether he's a, you know, a warning, you know, of what the horrors of, originally that's what the concept was, at least for Japan, was, you know, you have unleashed this monster upon society and it destroys without any compunction or any remorse. It is, you try to control it, but you can't. And it's just, what have we done?
It's very weird to think about how this all came from like a weapon of mass destruction that we've never, like that's where it took off.
Right. And that's where, you know, it was a weapon at first because, you know, we see it a lot. I mean, you see it a lot in times of war where it's like innovation is all organized towards war, towards fighting, towards destruction. That's where it comes in. But you have, during wartime, you have tons of innovation. So you have things like, you know, military technology, things like that have become, you know, the internet was originally designed for military computers, allowing them to do that, satellite technology, all that kind of stuff. All the stuff we have today is most of it's based off of stuff that was originally designed for military purposes. But I it's hard for me to say. I would say the internet affected us more than the atomic bomb would, but it's hard for me to judge whether the atomic bomb or the internet, which had the more influence. I mean, you know, which had more influence. It's kind of, it's an interesting thought to think about, you know?
Well, we're almost at our 45 minute HT confidential mark. So let's wrap this up. Final thoughts on cowboy atomic culture.
It's like, I would have named it something. I would have called it edging the devil or something.
Edging the devil. That would have been great.
But yeah, dude, again, it's not that they didn't understand. A lot of people would be like, oh, they were fucking with stuff that they didn't understand. They had a perfect understanding of what they were doing, and they just had the hubris to be like, and that was their downfall. It's like, you think you understand it, and you think you understand it so much, but it's actually, you know, again, the universe doesn't give a fuck about you. Atomic energy doesn't give a fuck about you.
And it's one of those things where it's like, again, it's not like Harry died, whatever, 7 months earlier, and they were like, man, that's weird. Harry just melted of natural causes. Like, they knew it was a direct link because of the incident. They're like, shit, he got radiation. They treated him for like radiation poisoning and acute radiation syndrome. Like, they knew what happened. And then they I would say they got even worse with safety.
Yeah. It's just, again, yeah. Well, they thought they had taken all the right precautions. They're like, yeah, we knew exactly what went wrong. He dropped that thing on there.
And we're not going to.
Yeah. But then, you know, another dude walks in here with a flathead screwdriver and says, like, yeah, this is a good idea. This is science.
Yeah. Forefront in his cowboy boots.
Yeah.
Jesus. Anyways, guys, thanks for listening. This is another episode of ATT Confidential. We got more of these coming at you. And as we always say at the end of these things, keep those eyes on the skies.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.